From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how do we cool down the toxic tensions in this country? U.S. Senator Gary Peters has one idea.
We got to get partisanship out of some of these basic core functions of the U.S. government.
Plus, it's retirement day for the director of the State Department of Transportation, and he's got parting thoughts for the next governor and state legislature.
It really comes down to one fundamental thing. If we want good roads, we have to pay for them.
What the greatest generation knows about technology that the rest of us don't.
It's not whether or not our elders can or cannot use technology or whether they do or don't. Everyone has their own opinions, but they all are choosing what they want to do because they've lived so long without it that it's not addictive like it is to you and I.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ask a Michigan voter, what are the top issues in this state? And chances are mighty good you'll hear something like this.
The biggest problem that we have in here is a lot of potholes and not taking care of roads. Some of the roads are not really kind of being maintained as much.
That was George Abwamsha from Canton, one of many voters who told us roads are their top issue. The state official who's been most preoccupied with our roads is the director of the Department of Transportation, Kirk Steidel, who today is retiring. Here with us now for the only interview he's giving on this last day on the job, MDOT Director Kirk Steidel. Welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So you're retiring after how many years?
31.
31 years. Okay.
31 look. Years as a public servant, 12 and a half year, almost 13 years as the MDOT Director.
So if you think about your legacy in public service, what do you think it is?
Well, I look at MDOT and I think about the initiatives we put in place to have the staff connected in communities to really understand what's important to communities as we're putting projects together to make sure we're doing them in context and in concert with communities. I look at efficiencies, how do we do things better and faster and cheaper and smarter and safer, and that as government employees, we work with people. We are much more civil. It's not about always being right. It's about working with people and doing what's right.
Kirk, let's think about those 13 years as the director of the Department of Transportation. What kept you up at night through the years, those staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m. thinking things over reasons?
You know, there's two things that really keep a DOT director anywhere in the country, well, particularly northern states, up at night, and the first one is not responding to a snowstorm. Well, I can tell you that that never occurred to me because I knew that on any given night, there were 3,000 snowplows that were taking care of snow in Michigan. So that wasn't ever really an issue for me. The thing that does concern me and did was that some major catastrophe was going to happen, like a bridge falling down. And people would die. And those are things that you know, as an engineer, you're trying to make sure that everything is safe and you got processes in place to catch the deterioration that's happening. But that's one of those, you just would dread that midnight phone call that said, hey, we had a bridge fall and three people are killed. So those are things that really, they're in the back of your mind all the time.
With the benefit of hindsight, as you look back, would you do anything differently?
I'm really proud of where the department employees have gotten, the innovations that they've put in place, the constraints that they've been working up against. They certainly don't have the resources that they need to be able to get done what everybody wants to have done. They've been really, really creative. And, you know, if I think about what would I have done different, you know, funding is probably the biggest constraint and the biggest thing that's holding us back. And as I think about the 13 years that I was involved in that conversation, I wish we could have got that done sooner because the deterioration, we'd have stopped it sooner. I don't know how I would have done that, and I don't know that I could have pushed any harder, but it's one that I wish we could have gotten done earlier.
I'm interested in your thoughts, Kirk, about the road plans that are offered by the gubernatorial candidates from the two major parties. You've got GOP candidate Bill Schuette calling for an audit of MDOT spending and how it allocates money, and he's promising to use his ties to President Trump to get more federal dollars for Michigan's infrastructure. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I've heard this top-to-bottom audit of MDOT for the last 10 years. Well, in the last 3 years, there's been 26 audits on 23 different areas of the department. And the Auditor General's been in there, done them. They haven't found what everybody seems to think they're going to find.
What do they seem to think they're going to find?
They think they're going to find a mountain of cash sitting somewhere that somebody is just, you know, not using appropriate, and it's not there. If you eliminated the whole finance department, the planning department, and a couple of others, you have a drop in the bucket. You have enough money to build one interchange, maybe. The other piece that's missing from that discussion is, of the MDOT budget, only 39% goes to MDOT. The other 61% go to cities and counties. So in the whole discussion all the time, it's all, well, we're going to, you know, fix the way MDOT allocates money. Well, that's in law. It's allocated as 39% for MDOT, and the other 61% goes to the other 619 agencies. So it's always interesting to hear people talk about that, but in reality, it's not there. I mean, they've looked under every rug. The Auditor General is really, really thorough. I've been through lots and lots of those audits. And if there was a mountain of cash sitting somewhere, they'd have found it by now. And I can tell you, I don't know where it's at, and I've been there for 13 years.
And Democrat Gretchen Whitmer is proposing an infrastructure bank, and then she says she's promising if lawmakers don't act, she said she'll go to the voters and ask for a bond. What do you think of that?
Well, the infrastructure bank is a good idea. The thing is, when it's a bank, you got to pay it back. So there actually is a state infrastructure bank that's in the Department of Transportation that local units of government use. It's a revolving fund that's about $20 million, and there is continual money in it. The issue is, when you take out a loan, you got to pay it back. And what communities have said is they don't really want a loan. They want a grant because they don't have the money to pay it back. So it's a good concept. It's got some shortfalls as well. You know, the other thing that I think everybody seems to talk about is, we're just going to get more money from Washington. Well, there isn't any more money that you can grab from Washington. There's a fixed amount that goes to each state. We draw down that amount every single year. If we have more state money, doesn't mean we can draw more federal money, because you hit the cap of how much money is available. So there isn't another $1 billion sitting in Washington waiting to come to Michigan. There's going to be some one-off grants that come through, and Michigan's done well some years and not so well in other years.
What's your recommendation, Kirk, to the next governor and to the next legislature to fix Michigan's crumbling infrastructure?
Well, it really comes down to one fundamental thing. If we want good roads, we have to pay for them. And how we pay for them is really up to the legislature. If they want to continue to use gas taxes and registration fees, then they're going to have to find a way to make those adjustments. If they don't want to do that, then they need to look at, is there general fund money that they want to move over, which, you know, we've done some of both in 2015. And then the last couple of years, there's been additional general fund money. But at the same time, then they got to identify then what other services in government do they want to prioritize lower than that. And then that's the debate they got to have. At the end of the day, if you just go back and look at the amount of money we were spending on infrastructure back in the 60s, 70s, even 80s, and project that forward with just the cost of inflation, just basic inflation, we are way under that right now.
So as you talk to us on your final day as the director of the Department of Transportation, what are you most looking forward to doing in retirement, and what won't you miss?
Well, there's a lot of things that I certainly will miss. I'm gonna miss a lot of the great people that I've had a chance to work with, both internally within the department and communities across the state, and some really great legislators. At the same time, I think the things that I won't miss is that it seems like every 2 years is Groundhog Day, and we start back over at square one. And that repetitive cycle is something I'm certainly going to be happy to not do anymore. You know, I had that same basic discussion for probably 13 years on here's where your gas tax goes and here's how it's spent.
What's your favorite road in Michigan?
Wow. You know, I really like the Tunnel of Trees, M119, just because it's so beautiful. You know, probably the second one is who could argue with M22?
I would say that's most people's number one answer. And Tunnel of Trees,
right.
Absolutely. MDOT yes. Director Kirk Steidel on his last day. Happy trails, happy retirement, and thank you so much for spending time with us on your last day here on Stateside.
Absolutely. Thanks, Cynthia.
And now, voter voices. As the countdown to midterms continues, we are trying to understand the issues most important to Michigan voters. So we sent reporters and producers all through the state to ask people two questions. First, what are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And secondly, what concerns you most about our political climate right now?
I'm Brian Grothy from Onsted, Michigan. Border security, the right to life, the sanctity of life. Those are the two primary issues, yeah. I think the platforms are so far removed from each other, especially the two main political parties. There's not much gray area or much common ground for them anymore to come together other than for the benefit of the nation. But their platforms are so isolating from one another. People have to make a clear choice. The gray areas are gone. It's right or left.
My name is Nora Ali. I live in Dearborn Heights, and I am a research assistant and student at the University of Michigan Dearborn. I believe that the issue that's the biggest for me would be immigration. I think it hits close to home. My parents are refugees, and seeing what's happening right now with family friends who are Yemeni who are having difficulty bringing over spouses and kids, that's what's most heartbreaking. I think what concerns me the most is the disregard for human life, really. I think everyone is viewing human life as a subjective thing, something that can be poked and prodded, and not what's actually there, which is a soul and an actual being. So everything has become politicized, and that's what's frightening to me, is we're no longer looking at each other and seeing eye to eye.
Special thanks to Mike Blank and Razi Joffrey for recording these interviews. Coming up, how people of the World War II generation are navigating today's technology.
It was always nice to have a personal contact, but that's so with anything. People are sending messages through email, and if you're not really tied to your computer, you miss a lot of information.
An interesting conversation. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. For decades, the Grand Rapids Public Schools District has been in charge of center-based special education for 20 districts across Kent County. That changes next year when control of these programs will transfer to the county's intermediate school district. This comes after intense criticism earlier this year from parents of special needs children about how GRPS was handling special education. Here to talk about that transition is Ron Kniff, who's superintendent of Kent Intermediate School District. Ron, welcome to Stateside.
Very glad to be here, Cynthia.
To start off, Ron, I'd like us to get a sense of just what these center-based programs do. What kinds of needs do the children attending these programs have?
Yeah, these are going to be the children who have profound disabilities, if you will, where they may not be able to be served with the necessary accommodations within their local schools or neighborhood schools.
What kinds of problems would these children be coping with?
They're exceptional children, but they may have physical limitations, significant cognitive impairments in some cases, an emotional impairment. They might be severely multiply impaired, and some of these children might be, you know, medically fragile, if you will. So they tend to be children with significant needs.
And as mentioned, Grand Rapids Public Schools for many years ran the center-based programs for 20 districts around Kent County. So this is a new responsibility for your team. What kind of preparation, what kind of ramping up is Kent ISD doing over the next year to get ready to take over these programs serving more than 1,300 kids?
That's a great question. You know, we're meeting monthly with the Grand Rapids team. Our staff, our team meets with their team. The lines of communication are open. We had already engaged the services of a consultant to help us study the programs, if you will. Now we are engaging that consultant to help us with the details associated with the transition. You know, just as an example, we do not provide food service at Kent ISD right now because the students that we have are here for partial day in career tech ed type programs. Well, next year we're going to be involved with food service because these children are obviously going to be with us for the entire day. So that's just one example, but there's a lot of detail engaged in this work. Could be transportation, it might be related to technology, and of course, obviously it's related to, you know, what's happening within the classroom, within the instructional programs, and getting geared up for that.
And to that point, will staff at the centers be able to keep their positions, probably understanding that there's probably a lot of relationships between the students and their instructors?
Sure, we hope so. We sure hope so, but that's one of those details. You know, currently there's a shortage of special education instructors throughout the state, and so we know that there's going to be a need. These students are going to be here. These students need qualified, talented, caring staff, and those teachers who are there now working with those children will be the first place that we look. But there may be, a situation where they don't want to come. They may want to stay with Grand Rapids Public Schools and not make the transition and come to work for Kent ISD. We're hopeful that many or most will take us up on that offer when it comes.
There was intense criticism earlier this year about the Grand Rapids Public Schools' handling of special education programs and of its special education director. Criticism coming from parents of students, many parents of students. What are you hearing from those parents as far as their concerns on how the centers were being run and what they're looking for from this transition?
You know, this decision the Grand Rapids Public Schools made, I really do believe, was not related to any of that concerns that were expressed and became quite public. I mean, this was a discussion that started with the leadership of Grand Rapids well in advance of that. For most areas of the state, that's how the state works, is that the ISDs are the providers and provide the center program service for special needs children within their ISD or within their county. We were the exception to the norm. I will say, you know, we are working hard at listening to the concerns of parents, to the concerns of staff, to all stakeholders as we go down this path. We've held some town hall meetings where we've listened. We have engaged in some focus groups. We're trying to get our arms around the issues and how we can make a great program even better. So it starts with listening and trying to be very intentional with that, and that's what we've tried to be.
And as you're having town hall meetings or as you're talking to unions or talking to parents, what concerns are you hearing?
The concerns that we've heard thus far is, are we ready for it? Can Kent ISD take on this challenge? And we believe that we can. These are programs that need a tremendous amount of attention and focus. I will say, when it's part of a K-12 district's operating system, there are systemic issues being a part of a K-12 district. As being part of an ISD, we can give it the focus and the attention that it warrants. Any school district trying to operate a K-12 program has its challenges. And the largest system in our ISD, in this case Grand Rapids Public, has done some exceptional things, but it still has its own district to run and to operate. And then you layer on top of that to say, hey, we want you to operate these specialty programs on behalf of the other 19 school districts within Kent County. That's a tall ask. Grand Rapids has done it and done it well for decades. But that system was designed in a different era and a different time. Accountability systems have changed. Educational systems have changed. So it just became apparent for us to take on the operations.
I know it's early. You have this ongoing review by an independent evaluator that you'll be gleaning information from. But bottom line, will parents and students see changes? Will the programs be a different kind of program under you at Kent County ISD than they were under Grand Rapids Public Schools?
I think one of the things with special education is that it's very rule-driven, rule-oriented, you know, in terms of caseload sizes, classroom sizes, if you will. So a lot of that is dictated and driven by the system that we're in here in Michigan and even under federal rules and laws. So, there won't be necessarily an overnight change. I suspect, if anything, it'll be a gradual change. It just comes with the culture of coming underneath the operation of a new organization, Kent ISD.
And it is ultimately all about the students. Ultimately, Ron, what are you hoping that this transition will mean for these special education students at the center-based programs?
We pride ourselves here, not to try to sound arrogant or to be arrogant, but we want to operate the best programs that we possibly can. And I know Grand Rapids feels the same way. If we're going to take on the operation of these programs, we want them to be world-class. And what that means is that the children being served, in some cases adults being served, because Michigan law, these are students up to age 26 before they age out and exit these programs. But we want them to be world-class. We want them to be high-quality programs that focus on instruction. You know, there's a temptation with this model sometimes because of the medical needs of some of the students being served that you kind of operate under a medical model. We want to challenge these children instructionally, help them grow and learn just as we want for all children. These are exceptional children, and we want them to learn and grow and have a high-quality experience.
Ron Kniff, superintendent of Kent Intermediate School District. The ISD will be taking control from the Grand Rapids Schools of center-based special education for more than 1,300 students in Kent County, and that transition will happen next year. Ron, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
My pleasure, Cynthia. Thank you.
Look at any photo of people from the 1920s on up to the mid-90s. Besides the styles of clothing or hair, what stands out? Well, I notice this. People are eyes up. They're looking around. They're looking at each other. Noses are not buried in a smartphone. Now, we know technology has changed us, but exactly how? The best way to figure that out is talk with people whose lives straddle the periods of BT and AT, before technology, after technology, which is what Veronica Kieran did. Her results are in her new book, Stories of Elders, What the Greatest Generation Knows About Technology That You Don't. Veronica Kieran, welcome. Very good to have you here.
Hi, thank you, Cynthia.
So what gave you the idea to go around the country to talk to our elders about their thoughts on technology?
Well, I conceived the idea in 2015 when I was running a tech company, and I started to notice that technology was having a very strange effect on my own life. It was changing how I was communicating. It was changing how I would see people, how often I would see my family and friends, my community, my relationships, and I started to get uncomfortable. Now, the unique thing is that at that time in 2015, that's when the media started to really get a hold of this idea of what is technology doing to us. In my background, being in anthropology, I said, okay, if I'm getting curious about this and everyone's getting curious about this, the thing to do is to go talk to people. And so that's how the story started.
The people who very well remember life without, because
yes.
if I look around me with my group of coworkers, largely it's people that they've never known a world without the internet, without a smartphone.
Right, right. And I'm arguably too young mm-hmm. to offer any. I grew up memorizing phone numbers and using rotary phones and going and knocking on doors to see if friends could play. But the internet came in my adolescence, so I couldn't comment mm-hmm. in the same way people who lived a lifetime without it could.
So ultimately, how many elders did you talk to?
Just shy of 100.
And what about age ranges?
Everyone's born before 1945. The oldest person I spoke with was born in 1911.
That's something. And I understand you drove 11,000 miles around 40 states to find these folks.
Yes.
That's commitment. So what does the greatest generation know about technology that the rest of us don't?
The thing that I learned spanning all of these interviews is intentionality. It's not whether or not our elders can or cannot use technology or whether they do or don't. Everyone has their own opinions, but they all are choosing what they want to do because they've lived so long without it that it's not addictive like it is to you and I. And so when they say, I don't want to be on Facebook, they're actually choosing not to. While some of them are saying, I want to be on Facebook and I'm meeting people who are strangers all the way around the world and making friends with people I've never met before. So it goes in both directions, but it's always the choice.
It's intentionality. Let's listen to what a lady named Pauline Etzani has to say about computers.
I really annoyed with everything that's computerized. I think that's segregating people who aren't adept at technology. So it's really doing a disfavor to people who weren't raised with this. And a lot of places don't allow you to do anything but be on email. It's always nice to have a personal contact. But that's so with anything. People are sending messages through email. And if you're not really tied to your computer, you miss a lot of information.
That is so thoughtful, and it's not the get off my lawn kind of approach. She is pointing out a very good point that not mm-hmm. everybody chooses to be on board with this, and we are being segregated.
Mm-hmm. And not everybody has access either. And it's not just our elders that may not have access. It's young people, too, who may not have access depending on their school district or their home life.
Or rural areas where broadband is not present, certainly. Yeah. So what were the main reasons that you heard people coming down in favor of technology?
Well, they're in awe. The fact that someone can see their grandson only hours after their birth, even though they're 100 miles apart. You know, we have Skype that allows it to. Knee replacements that they don't have to walk as cripples. They can go and they can have surgery and then they get full mobility back or more mobility than they had before. One woman in the book said that all her life she was labeled as sway-backed. And turns out she has osteoporosis and scoliosis, but we didn't have those words. We didn't know what that was in her youth. And so now we can do something about it. Travel, connectivity, I mean, everything that we're in awe of, they're in awe of as well.
But they're not addicted largely in the way that we just keep checking that screen all the time to see.
Or they notice when they are getting addicted. One woman talks about, I noticed we were on our devices all the time and I wanted to do something about it. So me and my husband started going on dates, leaving the phones at home once a week.
In your chapter on parenting and education, you dive into something that on a lot of minds, and that is wondering what the smartphones are doing to our kids. And there's certainly a sense that they are way too hooked on the phones. They are never far from them. They're under the pillow. They're checking, you know, messages and tweeting and Instagram, whatever, Snapchatting during the night. But there is a case, is there not, to be made that we can access information so easily and our kids have these powerful tools right in their pockets to help us learn. What does the Greatest Generation think?
It seems like, yes, they are in awe of how children are so easily learn how to use this tech so fast. But they do have the concern of what's happening to their eyesight, what's happening to their necks, social skills, etc. So they're straddling both sides of the story. They have the awe and they have the concern, and that's where intentionality comes back into play.
So what was their warning or their wisdom for the younger generation about approaching technology and using technology?
Really focusing on using it as the tool that it is, using it to enrich your life rather than allowing it to capture your attention all the time. We all know that Facebook is designed to capture your attention so that they can make money on ads, right? So instead of allowing that, stepping back and saying, how do I want to use this tool? Why am I purchasing it? What's my life going to look like with it?
I'm speaking with Veronica Caron about her book, Stories of Elders, What the Greatest Generation Knows About Technology That You Don't. She drove 11,000 miles across more than 40 states to interview some of the final living members of the Greatest Generation, the people born before 1945. And you spoke to folks here in Michigan. What did you learn from them that you didn't know before?
I learned a lot about our history corporate-wise. I got an inside look at GM, the evolution of Detroit. I spoke with a woman whose dad was involved in the labor strikes in Detroit, so really got a flesh and bones history of that. Talked to a lot of people who worked at Dow as well, so learning about not only that company, but then the work that it does statewide. And then certainly in my region of West Michigan, how things have evolved evolved and grown there. And then the social side of it. For example, I didn't know that we had German POWs working on farms in Michigan. And yet somebody told me, yep, my grandmother had that farm and I watched these POWs working with us.
It brings it certainly brings the pages of the history book to life when you hear
exactly.
those stories. And you had a chapter on amenities. I found that interesting. There was a woman named Betty Siegel who talked about how much she loves the laundry detergent cap, that most of us just we take it for granted. Why did she love it so much?
Well, she was describing how laundry caps used to be just like the cap of a regular bottle. You put it on after you've dumped the detergent in and poured it in. You put that thing back on and it drips down and it makes a mess. And so you have to have a cloth and you have to wipe it down. And she said, look, somebody engineered what you and I take for granted, that that stuff can fall back into the bottle rather than pour all over my counter. And her point was technology kind of spans a lot of different things. And there's gratitude to be had even in the smallest things around us.
Well, we would do well to listen to these wise voices and try to learn from them. Veronica Curran, her book is Stories of Elders, What the Greatest Generation Knows About Technology That You Don't. A wonderful project, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Know what that music means? Stay with us because we're bringing you a ghost story from Michigan's Thumb in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 6 days before we head to the polls for the midterm election, the backdrop to Election Day is full of turmoil. The synagogue shootings, the Kroger shootings, the pipe bombs, the drumbeat of alarm coming from Fox News and the White House about the caravan of asylum seekers making their way to the U.S. border. Well, let's talk about all of this now as we welcome Democratic U.S. Senator Gary Peters, who is not up for re-election this time around. Senator, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be with you. That's why I'm so relaxed. I'm not on the ballot this year.
There you go. Everything that I just listed is only in the past week. We're in such a point in our history. What is fueling all of this in your view?
Well, it is, I think, a very troubling time in our history right now. We're seeing this just the division of people. I get it as I travel across the state of Michigan on a regular basis. Every week I'm out everywhere. We see that folks are kind of retreating into their respective tribal camps. Folks don't want to listen to people in the other camp or always try to justify what may be said within their camp. And this partisan nature is making it difficult for us to come together and understand we're all Americans. We got to find common ground, but it's becoming increasingly difficult. And it's not just in Congress. It's with everyday folk in our state as well.
Well, when you think about where this has been building up for a while. And I'm wondering your thoughts. How culpable are Democrats in creating this kind of divisive political climate?
Well, I think everybody shares responsibility for this. And once you start pointing fingers, you are definitely part of that problem if you're starting to point fingers, that we all have to show leadership and understand that we need to certainly speak out aggressively in politics and democracy requires people to be very forceful and to advocate for whatever they believe. But you can still do it in a respectful way, and we shouldn't in any way do it in a way that leads some people to think that violence is the answer, because that's never acceptable.
Well, people are looking to you in Congress to lead. And so what can and should you and all the other elected representatives be doing now to cool things down?
Well, one, to make sure that we don't spin up our rhetoric that can lead to that kind of environment where people think it's okay to do that. And sometimes in the heat of the campaign, that does happen. But I think more than ever, people need to be very conscious so that words truly do matter and be very careful with those words. But then also lead by example. It's something that I care very deeply about is that I work on a bipartisan basis. When I introduce legislation, I always seek out a Republican co-sponsor with me. I've got a very good working relationships with my colleagues in the U.S. Senate. I don't agree with them on a lot of issues, but there are a lot of issues I do agree with them on, and we try to find that common ground and introduce legislation to work together. I've passed legislation that way, and I think that example is extremely important.
You know, there is that sense that we hear from people that there's not enough leading going on and there's way too much putting the party ahead of the country. Now, if the Democrats take the House or the Senate, wouldn't the narrative be the same, just flipped to the other side of the coin?
Well, I hope not. I mean, there are some that think that that's what we have to do. And let me just say, I mean, we definitely have to be very forceful in our advocacy for the things that we believe in, standing up for the American people. But I hope we could lead in a way that governing is different than being on a campaign trail. You actually have to govern. And the way to govern is to bring people together. And the thing that I always say, that after the election's over, I have the privilege of representing everybody in the state of Michigan, not just those who voted for me, but everybody in the state of Michigan.
I know you're in town for a University of Michigan conference on the 2020 census. And earlier this year, you joined with other Democratic senators. You introduced the IDEA Act, the 2020 Census Improving Data and Enhanced Accuracy Act. It's a lot easier to say IDEA.
That's right, yeah.
What would this bill do and why is it important?
Well, the census is just vitally important for our country and a whole host of reasons, but we base our government structure, the way the legislatures are structured, based on the census. That goes back to our founders, who realized that you need to have representation based on the actual population. That's how the House of Representatives is determined. Our state legislatures, accurate counts also are important with how federal resources get allocated. A community that's undercounted will get less resources than other communities, especially problematic if the need's even greater. Mm-hmm. But if it's not counted properly, it's a significant problem. And it's not just government. It's private business use census data to locate businesses, to recruit employees, to figure out where they're going to be promoting products. So everybody relies on an accurate census, so we have to make sure it's done correctly. And I'm on a couple of committees that have direct responsibility. One is the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, as well as the Commerce Committee, where the Census Bureau is located. And so this act basically works in a variety of ways, but one would be, don't put new questions on a census questionnaire until it's been thoroughly researched.
So are we talking about the citizenship question that the Trump administration proposes adding to the 2020 form?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have this citizenship question put on onto the census. It hasn't been researched. It hasn't been tested. Folks are concerned whenever you add new questions, you can reduce participation rates in the census. And so then if you reduce participation rates, one, you get inaccurate data, or they try to then count everybody. Then you send people out in the field to start doing face-to-face. The cost to the taxpayers goes up dramatically. And that's why when you do something like this, and it may be something we want to do, but let's test it and see exactly how we do it correctly before you try to go out and implement a census that's going to be talking to hundreds of millions of people.
So the act was introduced when?
It was introduced a couple months ago.
And where are we with it?
Well, it hasn't moved. And the fact that the Republican Congress doesn't want to move it forward. You have Secretary Ross that made this decision to put this forward. There are a number of court cases. I think there's 6 lawsuits now filed. The biggest one is New York versus the Department of Commerce. And it looks as from the some of the information that's coming out that the reason for this question is political. It's not based on the reasons that they initially gave, that it was important to enforce to work with the Voting Rights Act. Early evidence shows what we've always feared, that there is a political motivation. And we should never be political about the United States Census. This should be objective, scientific data run by scientists like the folks that I talked to today at the University of Michigan Symposium. These are professionals who do survey research and statistics. Let's make sure that this is not partisan in any way. It leads to the opening of this segment. We got to get partisanship out of some of these basic core functions of the U.S. government. The census is one of those.
Final thoughts with 6 days to go before the midterms. What do you want to say to anyone saying, I don't know if I'm going to vote. I may sit this out.
Well, my point is you have to vote. If you want your voice heard, you have to get out and make sure that you are voting. Our democracy is structured in a way that your voice is not heard if you don't actually vote. We see the consequences of it, and folks who may not be happy with things that they're seeing in the country now realize that it's usually all directly related to the outcome of an election, and that's why you have to get out and make sure that your voice is heard.
U.S. Senator Gary Peters, thank you so much for being with us.
Always great to be with you.
Happy Halloween, all. All through this month, we've been bringing you some tales of the dark, scary, and the unexplained, our Spooky Stories series. Today, as the kids gear up for a night of trick-or-treating, we've got one final story to share. Jennifer Strauss is a professional storyteller from Traverse City, and she brings us a ghost story from Michigan's Thumb. But first, she tells us why ghost stories capture our imaginations.
Urban legends were an incredible craze in the 60s in the city of Detroit, as I'm sure they were in other places. But it was the stories we told to each other at sleepovers and around the campfire, those, it happened to a friend of mine, and we just loved being frightened by those stories. And so when I became a professional storyteller, I gravitated to those urban legends and scary tales. The ones that I love the best are the haunted tales from Michigan, and I've sort of focused on those in my repertoire over the last 10 years. When I was in high school, my dad used to cut articles out of the Detroit Free Press if they were about haunted sites or ghosts. One of the writers for the Free Press in those days was a woman named Marion Cucklow, and she would write about haunted places in Michigan that you could visit if you wanted to. Marion Cucklow took all her research, and she published a book called Michigan Haunts and Hauntings. When I became a storyteller, I purchased that book, and the last story in that book is called The Legend of the Ghost of Minnie Quay, and this is the story. Now, years ago, during the lumber era, James Quay was a businessman in Boston, a banker. There were six children in the Quay family when they lost their oldest daughter, Luann, to leukemia, which wasn't curable at that time. His wife was so grief-stricken at the loss of their oldest daughter, the family as well, they thought that it would be a good idea to move that family to a new place to have a brand new start. It was the boom of the lumber era in Michigan, and James Quay chose to move his family to a town called Forester, Michigan. They moved into a two-story wooden house next to the Tanner House Hotel. They put the year they moved in above the door, 1852, and the family name Quay, hoping that this new home would be a good one for the family. Minnie, she was the second oldest daughter, and she was not unlike the other young girls in a lumber town during that time. When a ship came in and set anchor, and those sailors came off of that ship, Minnie and her girlfriends would go down to the waterfront and watch them. One day a ship set anchor and a young man came down that pier and Minnie fell in love with him. No one remembers what his name is to this very day, but it wouldn't be hard to imagine what he looked like. 19, 20 years old, strong from life on the ship. To Minnie it sounded like he had seen the whole world because he had been to places like Detroit and Chicago and Sault Ste. Marie. She fell in love. It didn't take long in a small town like Forester for news to get back to her mother and father that she had been seen all alone with that sailor, walking hand in hand with him on the beach. And you can't blame her parents for being worried. Minnie was only 14, and it looked like she was in a serious relationship with a sailor. One night, she got home after curfew, and a big argument broke out in that house when her mother said, "Minnie Quay, I forbid you to ever see that sailor again." The next day, he would set sail. Minnie snuck out of the house, trying to make her way down to the pier so she could say goodbye to him one last time. But her mother chased after her, caught her before she could get to the boat, and she said, "Minnie Quay, I would rather see you dead than married to that no-good sailor." And she yanked her all the way home. In the spring, when the ice broke up on Lake Huron, news came into Forester that one of those ships had sunk in a spring storm out on the lake. And on that ship was that sailor that Minnie had fallen in love with. She was never able to say goodbye. She was incredibly grief-stricken, but she didn't show her emotions to her family. And 3 days after the news had come in, her mother and father packed up all the youngest Quay children to go on an all-day trip into Port Sanilac to get supplies. They left Minnie home with her little baby brother, Charles. It was an unusually warm spring day. Minnie left the house wearing a light white cotton summer dress. She walked down through the streets of town. Charles had gone down for his nap. She made her way down to the waterfront, It was such a warm spring day that all the old men were sitting in rocking chairs on the back porch of the Tanner House Hotel. They waved at Minnie. She waved back. She walked down to the end of the long pier, and before anyone could do anything about it, she plunged into the still, icy cold waters of Lake Huron, and she ended her life. She just wanted to be joined back together with that sailor that she loved, but fate was not kind to that young couple. Minnie was never joined back together with that sailor, and sadly enough, her parents had to bury a second daughter in the Forester Cemetery. The people of Forester will tell you that Minnie's ghost is not at rest. They still see her wandering the woods and the shores wearing that cotton summer dress. Her ghost still travels those shores, and if you go there, you may see her even to this day.
That was Jennifer Strauss, a professional storyteller from Traverse City. Her business is Story Be Told. And even though it's Halloween, it is still Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And we've got a special segment in store for you today because all month we've been bringing you Michigan ghost stories, many of them evolving from real stories, keeping a kernel of truth. So we decided to put the one you just heard through the litmus test of history. And for that, we turned to the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. So Rachel, we know that history means a lot to you, but are you also into ghost stories?
I am. I'm that person that loves cemeteries. I've done tours of old hospitals and prisons. So I love ghost stories.
Okay, with that in mind, let's dig into this ghost story that we just aired involving a young girl named Minnie Quay from Forester, Michigan. First of all, where is that town located and what was it like in the mid-1800s?
Forester is in Sanilac County. So as any Michigander, if you put your hand out to use for a map, it is just south of the tip of your thumb. So it's right on Lake Huron there. And in the mid-19th century, Forester was a busy town. It was part of the lumbering industry. It had the shipping industry there, and it also had a lot of mills. It was very busy. Lots of people from other countries that were living there. So you have a lot of immigrants living there from Canada and England and Ireland. It's a very, very busy, bustling town.
So the Quay family, real or a ghost story creation?
The Quay family is very real. The Quay family moved from, according to census data, they moved from New York in the late 1860s, probably about 1869. The 1870 census has them in Forester, and the last of their children was one, and they were the only one born in Michigan at that time. So that's how I can kind of say they showed up in Michigan around 1869.
So what do you know about Minnie?
Minnie was born Mary J. Quay in New York in 1860, and she, I'm assuming, this is what I don't know, was a pretty typical teenager, and she lived with her family in Forester. So she was 9 when she moved to Michigan, and the Quay family started, Mr. Quay started as a farmer and then eventually got into carpentry. So they lived in town and were very well known.
So does the story of the real Minnie Quay at all match or mirror the tale of the ghost story of Minnie Quay?
There are some things that line up. The story of Minnie Quay and her young man that she falls in love with, I have not found any evidence of him actually existing. That doesn't mean he doesn't. I have not exhausted every single possible source out there. But if you look at newspaper accounts of her death and others' accounts, he's not mentioned. He just comes in the oral history that has sort of come down over time. So I can't find him. I would love to believe he exists, but I cannot find him.
And so, what became of the rest of the family?
The family ends up staying for a little while in Forester. Mr. Quay dies in 1887, and Mrs. Quay stays in Forester until about the 1910s, where she ends up moving in with one of her sons in Detroit. And she remains in Detroit until her death in 1931. So she's 98 when she dies.
Wow.
And the kids move away. Some of them wind up out west in California. Some of them stay in Michigan. But it looks like most of them move away from Sanilac County, at least for a time.
So all in all, if you dig in, there is certainly a kernel of truth in the ghost story we just heard.
There is. There's always a kernel of truth.
Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center. Happy, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty, wishing all of you a gently spooky and very fun Halloween. Thanks for listening.